When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi, and welcome to Everything is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. We are your hosts, Talia Bacassus
and Kim France.
And today we're talking about failure.
Whee!
It feels appropriate for a show for women over 40, right?
Very, very appropriate for a show for women over 40, because at this point in our lives, we've probably all had some failure interspersed with our successes.
The failure is what we harp on, I think, and that's a common human trait. I looked up some famous women who failed before they succeeded, and big names that I saw were J.K. Rowling, Oprah, Vera Wang, Arianna Huffington. J.K. Rowling apparently was a struggling single mother on welfare and was rejected 12 times for the first Harry Potter book, which was baffling.
Yeah, it really is.
And I found this quote from her, which I thought was pretty on point. "Some failure in life is inevitable. It's impossible to live without failing at something, unless you live so cautiously that you might as well not have lived at all, in which case you fail by default."
Definitely.
So tell me about your relationship with failure.
So for 10 years, I edited a magazine called Lucky, which was a magazine about shopping that was launched by Condé Nast and became very successful and then was hit by the market downturn of 2008 very badly. And by 2010, I was fired. I had known things weren't going especially well. I knew that for our September issue, which is the big bellwether for the year as far as how you're doing with ad pages, we were behind, and every other women's magazine was up for the first time since the market had turned. And I would see other fashion magazines come to my apartment and into my office, and they were all fatter than ours. And I wasn't, you know, I knew something was up. However, nobody ever spoke to me about it. I was never taken aside by a boss and told, you know, "We're really concerned about your performance. Maybe you need to focus more on X. Maybe you need to do Y." There was never anything like that. I simply received a phone call, or my assistant did, late one afternoon, right after Labor Day, telling me to come in and see my boss the next day. And when I asked my assistant if he said what the meeting was about, she said no. And I said, "Did you ask?" And she said, "Yes." And I was like, "Okay, that can't be good."
Oh, really? So you had a feeling?
I had a feeling, but I talked to my managing editor and we somehow convinced ourselves it was about something else. And then that morning, the meeting was like at 10 a.m. And that morning I was on the phone with a cousin. It was Rosh Hashanah and I was going to see him that night. And it just hit me. Like, I'm about to go upstairs and get fired. That's what's about to happen. It just totally came to me. Wow. "You are crazy if you think it's anything but that." And I walked upstairs. I walked into my boss's office. He closed the door. And when he closed the door, I knew that beyond a doubt that that was it. And he told me they were making a change. And that conversation was pretty quick. And the next day it was, you know, within hours, it was in the news. The Times called almost immediately. They heard about it and they wrote a piece about it the next day. And it felt very, very public. And I had never had a failure like that. I had only had success in my career. And to have my first failure be something that was visible to anybody who was interested was not ideal.
It sounds like an understatement.
Yeah.
How do you feel now talking about it?
I feel fine talking about it. I mean, even the day that it happened, which was a very rough day, I knew that this was for the best. I knew that my time at Lucky had been rocky, that even though I might have been good initially at putting out a magazine about shopping, that I was not cut out to be an editor-in-chief at Condé Nast. It just wasn't in my DNA. And the longer I spent straining to fit that mold, the worse it affected me physically, emotionally. And I had migraines almost every day. And I knew when I got fired that the migraines would go away, which they did. And I got back in touch with myself as a writer. And that was a really exciting thing to do. I felt like I had sort of descended into hackdom, just editing. And it was really wonderful to be like, oh, yeah, I can still write. This is something I can still do. And my life on a day-to-day basis is so much better since that happened that it's hard to even quantify. But I do have feelings about never reaching that level of success again, which I feel fairly certain I won't, you know. And I know it's monetary success and it's sort of like success in the eyes of others when I have my other successes I should focus on. But it's mm-hmm. hard.
When your book comes out, you will reach another level of success.
Yes.
For me, I had my biggest and most painful professional failure last year, which is kind of the thing that set this podcast in motion. But I used to have this documentary podcast called First Day Back, where I followed people after they had a big life setback. And it was financed by one of the biggest podcast networks around. And it was written up in Vulture as one of the best podcasts of the year. And it was profiled in The New Yorker. And after the third season, the executive producer told me that they weren't going to renew it for a fourth season. Actually, what she said is, we're not going to do it for now.
Oh, that was like a cop out.
I know. I was like, I think you mean forever. What was really hard about it was that a lot of things hadn't been working for the last season, and I had felt like I was going to break up with them. Like, it was like the boyfriend who broke up with me before mm-hmm. I was going to break up with him. And I was like, wait a minute, I was going to break up with you. You just got there first. I was so pissed. And for me, I mean, like, I had access to seeing the numbers, and so that I knew that season two had been really, really great, and season three, the audience numbers just weren't the same as they were in season two, and that was partially also the market. Everything with podcasting has exploded, so it stopped being viable. And after that happened, I fell into a funk for like 3 months where I was just lying on the couch refreshing my email, and I felt like, okay, this is it. Nobody's ever going to email me again. I was like refreshing my email, and it was just the J. Crew newsletter every 2 minutes.
No, I mean, it's really hard. It's hard to feel like something's going to come next in
exactly.
the aftermath of that.
Exactly. Because you're not there yet. You're not at the next thing yet. So you're thinking that's just it.
Mm-hmm.
And my producer, who I love dearly, went on to a much bigger and better job afterwards. And I was like really honestly very happy for him, but it also highlighted to me that I can't really apply for those jobs right now. Most of them are in New York. I'm not going to pick up and move my whole family. The job that he took was the kind of job where like you had to work like 15, 16 hour days. I'm not at a point in my life where I can do that. So that was kind of hard as well.
Yeah.
It also feels really terrifying to say this stuff out loud because I feel like, I mean, you're at a point where it's much further in the past, and I'm at a point where people who know me and who didn't really know this story will possibly listen to this.
Well, so. It feels like, I mean, this is an obnoxious way to put it, but it feels like you're advertising your loserdom. Like, I feel that way a little, even talking about it 10 years ago in the past. Like,
okay,
I was fired, you know.
Exactly.
But it happens to everyone. There's nobody who isn't touched by failure after a certain stage in life. It's a fact of life.
Yeah, that makes me feel better. So today, we're going to be talking to Lauren Ober, And she's the host of the podcast Spectacular Failures, which is a show about some of the biggest business failures of our time. Lauren is also pretty familiar with personal failure. I met her a few years ago before she was hosting that show. She was hosting a show at the time called The Big Listen, which was a podcast, and eventually it was a national show. And it was canceled too, like my show. And she had all kinds of work upheavals prior to that. In fact, when she was talking to me about getting hired for Spectacular Failures, when they called her, they didn't have a title for the show yet. And then she was hired and she found out the show was going to be called Spectacular Failures. And she was like, oh, perfect. So welcome to the show, Lauren.
Hi, thanks.
Yeah, it feels like your show has been a runaway hit. Like, basically, people really want to hear about failure.
I think there is some cachet to talking about failure or sort of owning failure. I don't know if my show is a runaway hit, but I think people are interested in collapses and fails and foibles. And, you know, there's some sort of, you know, Schadenfreude in the whole endeavor of failure and failure stories.
So tell us, what is working on a show about failure taught you about it?
That... particularly in business, you know, the folks responsible for failure are very infrequently held to account for that failure. And that's a bummer, you know, because it's like, well, it's not the workers' fault and it's not the shareholders' fault. It's your fault.
Well, I don't know if either of you read in Vanity Fair, there was an enormously long piece about WeWork and their failed IPO.
Oh, yeah. Right. That was so fascinating. For people who might not know about WeWork, who are they again?
Well, WeWork is a company that started, I don't know, right around the time of the economic downturn, actually, I think. And they do co-working offices. And if you're in any major city in the United States, you probably are familiar with them. And the CEO of WeWork and the founder, who sounded like such a piece of work,
yes,
said, basically, among other things, that in 300 years, his heirs would be running the company. he walked away. He walked away with $1 billion.
Sure.
Wow.
Sure. The golden parachute very much exists. And because the world of big business and capitalism doesn't work in the way that our world, you know, the people who walk on the ground, it doesn't work like that. You know, I mean, if you lose everything for your family, you know, you're out on the street. You know,
yeah.
If you lose everything for your company, they're like, well, OK, thank you for your service. Here's $1 billion. You know,
mm-hmm.
It really is shocking and gross.
It's pretty fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really
yes,
is.
Yes, that's one way of putting it. Also, you know, there's the failing up.
Kim, you mentioned that idea to me, failing up.
I've never even
heard that.
Failing up is when somebody has a position, they're not especially distinguished, they don't distinguish themselves in the job, and yet somehow they manage to parlay the success they have with greater success and newer jobs, better jobs.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I watched a lot and have continued to see in my world. There were certain editors in magazines who became editors-in-chief, did a really, you know, average job, none of their numbers improved, and went on to get other jobs. I think that when you fail up, you're also very good at managing up.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So managing up, meaning you, how you work with
the
your
bosses.
Superiors. Right. Right.
So that's kind of all about managing the relationships, and failing up is like, they look at somebody and they say, well, this person did an okay job and they're just the right look for our company. Like, what? I think it is.
They know how to play the game. You know, okay. And one of the things that I learned at Lucky, because Lucky was a different kind of magazine than had existed before. And one of the things I learned at Condé Nast is you can break the rules, but you must always, always, always play the game. And people who manage up know how to play the game.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. I mean, I think that, you know, there's been research that people would rather work with somebody who was nice and agreeable and less competent than somebody who was extremely competent but was not, you know, but was prickly. And people will excuse whatever failings, you know, you have in any number of ways because, you know, you're agreeable. And some people find it hard to be agreeable all the time. I'm one of those people.
Well, some of the great bosses are some of my best bosses have been some of the craziest assholes.
Right.
But just the people who I've actually learned from were the people who were the least flexible in some ways and the most critical.
Right.
But who I really learned an enormous amount from.
I wonder for you, can I ask a question?
Is that all right? Of course.
I'm wondering at the levels that you worked at, Kim, if you saw that women were held to a different standard with regard to, you know, your attitude and your friendliness and your, you know, how you interacted with superiors and all of that.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the thing about the magazine industry and fashion magazines in particular is that for years before women had power positions at other types of magazines, they were running fashion magazines.
Right.
So there were always a lot of women in positions of power. However, the people at the tippy top were men, always. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there was a lot of pressure, and I failed in this respect in a big way, to be agreeable to... You know, like I said, manage up to even in a way flirt. Not with an end, not with anything in mind, but just to flatter. It was about flattering. And, you know, it came into play always with advertisers.
And
I was no good at that type of thing. Chatting up advertisers, I got a D minus on.
It's taken me a really long time to learn that there is a game and that you need to play it, which is weird because I was an athlete in college. Like, I played Division I sport. I clearly, you know, I knew about teamwork and rules and all of that stuff and training. But I felt like maybe it was because the goals were always murkier when you got into business, because my goals are different than the advertiser's goals, are different than the editor-in-chief's roles, like goals. They're just sort of different. And maybe it's, you know, as I've aged and mellowed, I sort of know how you need to grease the skids, and that everybody kind of has a different motivation. And not everybody's motivation is going to be like, we're going to make the best thing ever, all the time, forever, you know? And it's hard to realize that, I think, sometimes.
All right, let's just take a break here for some ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Okay, back to our conversation with Lauren Ober. Do you guys think failure is sometimes a question of framing as well? Because, like, Kim, the one thing that always strikes me is that I think about your time at Lucky as a success in that you did it. Like, and for most of the time that you were there, it was probably, there were many years of it being successful.
Yeah, it was.
You see it as a failure just because you're focusing on the end kind of thing. And for a lot of people, like, they're not thinking about that part of it. They're thinking about the fact that you did it and it existed.
Yeah, in New York, they're thinking about the fact that I failed. I really think. But no, it's true. Lucky was the most successful launch in Condé Nast history. It turned a profit faster than any magazine Condé Nast had ever launched. And that was a big success. You know, and that's a whole other episode, like dealing with success and allowing yourself to feel happy about that. I think that failure feels more like my water level, even though my career had always gone well previous to that. But I think the reason why the failure stings is because some of the reasons I got fired, I don't blame them for. I feel like they were, I had fallen down on the job. As my older brother said to me, you were daring them to fire you.
What do you mean exactly?
Well, I think, you know, I don't want to get too deep into it, but I think the magazine had a formula. We stuck to the formula too much. I didn't grow the magazine in the ways that I should have. I was really, I think it was a good thing. I was pretty obsessed with what the readers thought, the reader experience of the magazine, and that was not considered a good thing by management.
Oh, that's bizarre, because that sounds really like the right thing to be focused on.
Yeah, but you got to care about the advertisers, and you've got to care about the Cirque, and you've got to, you know,
there are all these
other things. And I also, I didn't go to fashion shows. I hated fashion shows, and I had terrible migraines, which kept me from going to them, in addition to hating them. You know, you got to be there in the front row representing at the fashion shows. If that's your game, you've got to play it.
Anna Wintour proves that. She's always there.
She's always there.
Or a hologram of her is there. We don't know.
I think she's... I've actually stood very close to her. I'm not sure she's not a hologram.
Well, it's great that you're able to sort of recognize where there was some fault. I think that's a really important part of failure, is to be able to assess your... you know, what you are responsible for. Unless it is sort of... abjectly not your fault, you know, like that's that demonstrably you did nothing wrong, and there are certainly those cases. But I think when you're sitting at the top of a show or a magazine or something, a movie, and it flops, you know, there's some responsibility there, a little bit. I mean, it's a team effort, certainly, and it's, you know, one person cannot make a magazine or cannot make a show. But you know what I'm saying? It's a team effort. But if you were at the top, like the buck stops with you, and there is something where, and I think it's the sort of dignified thing to do to say, yeah, I did this and I could have done this. And, you know, rather than blame everyone else.
Well, it's not only dignified, but when you talk about like wanting to learn from your failures, it's kind of the only way is to take stock of like, okay, what did I do right and what did I do wrong? That's the only way to take something from the experience and to be able to move past it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would agree.
Right. But also not beat yourself up over it, because like, all right, well, yeah, I could have done this. Like, there are a million things in a day that I could have done better.
It's
really great to have like 20/20 hindsight, but it's like, well, maybe if that hadn't happened, then you didn't get to do this other thing. And I mean, I'm a bright sider. Like, I'm a very much a closet optimist. Like, don't tell anyone, but I do sort of bright side things, not outwardly to people. Like, I don't want to be that person who's like, everything's fine, it's great, you know, but in my own mind, I'm like, yes, it has to work out. Like, it will work out, or, you know. And maybe that's just the sort of fuel that keeps the little train going. So
I like that. I'm a closet bright sider.
See, I'm not. I am so not. I am always a half empty in the biggest way. I think that, you know, I'm a half empty walking around disguised as a half full.
Are you Jewish?
I'm very Jewish, yes. Extremely.
Kim, it's not your fault.
But that is your birthright. So
it's true.
I would be weirded out if it was otherwise.
Well, you hide it very well, because I haven't really thought of you that way.
Oh, well,
I think maybe it's for yourself. Maybe it's a standard that you only apply to yourself.
Well, I think I do. I'm very critical of myself. I'm very, you know, at the same time, I think I've acknowledged what I've achieved. You know, since Lucky, my career has taken a path that has been much quieter. It's, you know, not nearly as lucrative, but my life is a better life. At the same time, I don't think I would have been satisfied in life if I hadn't achieved something on the level of lucky. Having done it, I don't feel the need to ever do something like that again.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like running a marathon, right? People are like, great that I did it. Never want to do it again.
Yeah, that's how it feels. And I also, going through, like, I went through, in the period of time that I was the editor of Lucky, I had a serious depression, cancer, divorce.
Ooh. Oh.
A breakdown. Mm-hmm. I don't think those things were unrelated. I mean,
that job was not healthy for you, Kim.
It wasn't healthy for me. And I, you know, and I was like unbelievably thin and, you know, a chain smoker smoking in. Mm-hmm. We had private bathrooms. That was one of the wonderful things about being at Condé, an editor in chief at Condé Nast, is you had your own bathroom in your office and it was really well ventilated. And so I would just sit in there and smoke.
You're like a high school kid. I love it.
It was
in the bathroom. Well, I imagine that there was enormous pressure working in a fashion publication or a, you know, that focused on retail and be the representative of, you know, like to be the aspirational leader of the publication. You know, you can't you can't roll up in sweats every day with your hair in rat's nest. Like, you got to present. And I'm sure that's very stressful.
Very stressful. It was super stressful. And I wasn't that great at it. Like, we had a meeting once a month called Print Order. And that was when you showed the big bosses every page of the magazine, page by page. The other female editors in chief in the building would get hair and makeup done before Print Order.
Shut up.
Hair and makeup. Every time.
That is insane.
I would roll up and say to my executive editor, like, do I have any stains on anything I'm wearing? Am I okay for this, Kim?
I love you.
That is incredible. I love
You're
that.
You're the best.
But, you know, that is part of why I got fired, too. You know, I didn't.
Because you're a normal human.
I like to think I stayed normal. I would like to think that.
Gosh, that is really tough. But then, you know, but then you created a life that worked better for you on all kinds of levels.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a ghost in the world I used to formerly inhabit. But and if I thought about it that way, I think I would be very upset. You know, the failures that mean more to me, like my failure to become a mother, I'm 55. It's not going to happen. That is painful. That's the one that I will never have resolution with and that I can't learn anything from, you know, really. I mean, that's the one that like lurks out there.
That's I'm trying to think. Cheryl Strayed wrote about this, actually, and it's a really lovely quote about not having kids. Do you mind if I look it up?
No,
no, go for it.
Sorry. I use it all the time because I'm 41. I don't have kids. And it is like a pain point, but not because I was like, I desperately want to be a parent, but I was like, you know what? You realize once your friends have kids, you're like, oh, this is why people had kids. And then you're like, there are very particular feelings that you will never experience in your entire life because you didn't have children.
You see people with their kids and can you explain that again?
There are ways that there are feelings. There's a parental type of love that you will never experience. You might be on the receiving end of it, but you will never be on the giving end of it. And there are ways that, you know, there's a pride that, you know, even if your child isn't like the ace student and on all the school plays and the best kid on the track team, like you still have pride in your child just having a child. I mean, I imagine. And so, like, there are things like that you don't experience. And I often think about that. I don't think of it as a failure necessarily because it wasn't something that I was trying to do. But it's one of those things that by sort of not making a decision, I've kind of made a decision. And that doesn't feel amazing. And so I've been trying to sort of come to my own peace around that. But I did find the quote. I quite like this. And this is Cheryl. I can never say her name. Cheryl Strayed.
It's a little bit of a tongue twister.
Yeah. Tiny, beautiful things. Advice on life. advice on love and life from Dear Sugar. She wrote, "I'll never know, and neither will you, of the life you don't choose. We'll only know that whatever that sister life was, it was important and beautiful and not ours. It was the ghost ship that didn't carry us. There's nothing to do but salute it from the shore." And I really like that idea of, like, that is a different life. That is an equally good life. My life is good. It might not mean anything to anybody else, but I try to think about that. And I think about it in also like in work ways, like, okay, well, that path wasn't mine and that path wasn't mine. And I'm just like, those paths might be great, but they're not the path that I'm on.
I think, you know, that's exactly right. And I mean, the way I think of it, I was once in an AA meeting, to be honest, and I heard a guy talking about things that were going on with him. And he said a sponsor once said to him, "Don't mourn the life you didn't get."
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I think about it all the fucking time. Those are like my words to live by. And they brought me such freedom when I heard that guy say that. It's like, oh, that's what I've been doing. And of course, there's great dissonance if you do that. And you're not going to be very happy.
Sure. Sure. And I totally agree with that. That, you know, when you mentioned feeling sort of like a ghost in your industry, after the few times that I lost my radio hosting job, I felt like I had evaporated into the ether. Like, I truly felt like I had sort of decomposed and was just sort of in the mist somewhere, and that I somehow did not exist. I had to come to this feeling for myself, for this understanding that I am not my job. And it's very hard because I am a worker. I'm a workhorse. Like, I have always been a good worker. I pride myself on it. I enjoy work. But also that to remind myself that that is not why I have friends. That is not why I have people around me who love me. It's not because I host a show or because I can turn a clever phrase, you know, on the page. I mean, all these things as they're coming out of my mouth sound so Pollyanna-ish, like, everyone just loves you for you, you know?
No,
but actually is true in that, like, you know, if I stop being a professional writer, I stop being a professional podcaster, like, not a one of my actual friends and the actual people who love me will be like, yeah, no, we're good. Like, we don't need to hang out with you anymore. And again, I mean, these are not revelations, but they're things that help me sort of remember, you know, you sort of remember your place in your community. And I have a work community and that's fine. But I think the one that fills me up more is the social and familial community that I have.
No, for sure. So. After First Day Back was canceled, that was the only thing that I was able to turn to, was thinking, okay, I'm not my job. I'm not, because I relate so much to what you're saying, Lauren, because I'm such a worker bee. And even though I have kids, like, it's so big in my life, the work that I do. Mm-hmm. There are all these people on Instagram or Twitter or whatever, like, they'll have mom in their bio. And I'm just not that person because it doesn't feel like it's my identity. Like, I have kids. I love my kids, obviously. Like, but it's not. Right. I don't walk around the world feeling like a mom. I walk around the world feeling more like my career is my identity. And so when that thing ended, it was just, that was when I had to turn to, like, pivot my brain to my relationships and thinking, okay, these people love me and care about me, not because of the work that I do.
Right.
Yeah,
and it might be harder also in, I mean, New York is an unforgiving place, more so, I feel like, in other places. I mean, D.C. is cutthroat, but only if you're on the Hill, really. And so maybe, Kim, that wasn't your experience, because maybe so much of your, you know, your work and personal life were enmeshed, and so much of what you had to do was like social stuff. And
definitely,
maybe it did feel like a complete collapse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, that's not inaccurate. However, I so dislike doing so much of the social part. I mean, during the day that I got fired, they told me I could take till the rest of the week to get out of the building. And I was like, no problem. I will be out by the end of the day. And the rest of that day, it was like an Amish barn burning in reverse. Like, a few people who worked on staff just helped me dismantle my office all day long. And all day long, I'd keep thinking about, like, a bing, another thing I don't have to worry about anymore. Bing, this event I don't have to go to anymore. And it was just like so amazing. You know, there was also, bing, Cobra will run out eventually.
That's right.
You know,
that's
just bought an apartment.
I know. I bought a place when I didn't have a job. It was the only time I was like, well, I'm never going to be able to get a mortgage as a freelancer. And I still had like 2 months left on my contract. And I was like, well, it's kind of now or never because I have no idea when I'm ever going to get a real job. And I remember, you know, talking to my physical therapist of all people. I was like, I don't know if I should do this. Like, this seems really scary. Like, I don't have a job. And how can I buy a house? And she was like, sometimes that's the way things happen and you just got to do it. And I was like, yes, physical therapist, that's exactly right. You're totally right. I'm going to buy the house because my physical therapist told me to. You know? So ridiculous. But like but in those times, you're looking for guidance and inspiration wherever it turns and, you know, wherever it pops up. And I'm just like, yes, exactly what she said. You know, where are the papers? Where do I sign?
You said something to me on the phone, Lauren, that I thought was interesting. You mentioned the idea of having PTSD from failure. How do you think that works?
I think that, you know, of course it stays with you.
I guess it's the idea of being gun shy after, like, for the next time.
Yeah, I think it's something that you have to fight against. I think about actors a lot. I feel like actors are a really good model for how to deal with failure because particularly when they're starting off, you know, they're going to casting call, they're going open casting and they're doing all this stuff and it's just demoralizing. And then, you know, somebody is lucky enough to get a couple of roles and, you know, maybe they book a pilot and then the pilot gets picked up and then it's immediately canceled. And it's like, well, it doesn't mean my acting career is over. And for some people, I mean, I guess it separates the wheat from the chaff in some way, in that the people who have that resilience or who aren't, you know, who are too stupid to quit. Sometimes I think that's I say all the time, like, why am I in journalism? Why am I even doing this? This is so hard. It's volatile. Like, why didn't I become a CPA? You know, and it's like, well, because you are not suited for that life. You are suited for this life for some reason.
I know. It's like, why do I put myself in a situation where rejection is such a frequent part of my life?
Totally. I cannot speak enough about the importance of resilience and how I feel like that is make or break for people. And I see it all the time, particularly, I'm sorry to say, in men, but there are a lot of, you know, men who are very privileged and who have never had to deal with disappointment. And the one time they do, it's like, my life is over. Like, bleh. And it's like, if you were a woman, you wouldn't be saying this because you'd have to like take care of all the people, you know, having those reserves of resilience are the thing that have helped me out a lot. Because I was pedaling over here on my bike. And I was like, well, there's a really good possibility that I don't get a third season for my show. And then what do I do? And I haven't even started the second season yet. So that's there. And it's always sort of, you know, the undercurrent in the background happening. And I guess it's just ignoring, you know, the memory of how shitty it feels to fail.
Yeah, no, every time that I've failed at love, I've thought, that's it. This is the last time I even try. You know,
but how's that working out for you? Yeah. I'm never doing this again. And then like somebody walks in, you're like, okay, well, just this one more time.
Just this one time.
One thing we didn't talk about, but I was thinking that you might touch on is how maybe possibly if failure gets easier as you get older.
I think so.
Oh, I didn't think so. Well,
because you just have more to look back on and more sort of material to
more perspective, you mean, to say like, yes, okay, this wasn't such a big deal. I've bounced back before. I'll bounce back again.
Yes, perspective was the word I was looking for, not material. But I'm sort of material, sort of like, you know.
Life material. Yeah, life
like
material.
Like it, yeah.
Definitely
it's
all
thing
around
I think
me.
About, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I keep coming back to this expression that people just, everything is like, I give less fucks. And so a lot of times that means like, I know what matters and I know what doesn't. I know my family matters, let's say, and not this job or it's perspective. Yeah. What were you going to say, Lauren?
It's also just the treadmill of the social media and being like, cool, my life doesn't look like that. Whatever. you know. My mom is a big whatever person. Like, when I told her that I was gay, she goes, whatever. And it's really not the best coming out story, but it's also pretty hilarious. But like, her feeling, she says whatever about so many things, just sort of dismissiveness. And I've sort of adopted that. Great, you have an awesome podcast. Super much. It's like way better than mine. Whatever. I'm like, that's why I'll never get anywhere.
No. Kim, is there anything else you want to talk about?
No, I think this has been fantastic.
This conversation was a non-failure. Thank you so much, Lauren, for coming to chat with us. Do you want to tell people how they can find you?
Yeah, you can check out our show, Spectacular Failures, on any of the podcast players of your choice. Also, I'm on social media at Ober and Out, and our show tweets at Failure Show.
Thank you, and thanks to everyone for listening. Everything is fine. We are your hosts, Talia Bacassis
and Kim France.
If you like the show, be sure to rate it and write us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you have suggestions for show ideas or anything else, email us at tallyandkim@gmail.com. We also have an Instagram that is EIF Podcast, and you can find Kim on her blog, girlsofacertainage.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.